Hello and welcome to Ahead of the Curve. This is your host, Jonathan Gellner, and thank you so much for joining us today. This episode is brought to you by New Era. New Era is the official headwear provider of the MLB, NFL, and NBA. If you love to rock New Era caps as much as I do, then you won't want to miss this opportunity to wear what the players wear and get 15% off when you go to neueracap.com/AOTC and use code AOTC, all lowercase, at checkout. That's 15% off your order using promo code AOTC. On today's show, we have on Robert Valley, head baseball coach at Rowan College at Gloucester County, South Jersey. Rob is entering his 24th season of college baseball with 20 years of experience as a head coach. During that span, it includes an impressive 650-plus wins, averaging 35 wins per season. He's taken 12 trips to the NJCAA College World Series and won national championship last season. Regarded as one of the finer player development experts in college baseball, 28 of his players have been named All-American, and 72 have been in professional baseball and has 7 major leaguers. So on the show, we discuss their past season, which resulted in a national championship. We go through their fall player development program, which includes almost 30 games. And we talk about how to steal reps and develop in season. You're going to love this episode with Rob Valley. Rob, welcome to the show.
Yeah, I'm excited to have a chance to talk some baseball with you.
Definitely. Well, I am excited to get to know you a little bit better. I haven't had a ton of guys from Jersey on the show. One of my absolutely best friends is from Jersey, a good friend of mine named Steve Johnson. And and besides you and I think Barry Davis, and I actually coach with a guy named Sean Cashman that's a Jersey guy. And I've got a short list of guys that I know from Jersey that are baseball guys. So I'm excited to hear what you have to say today and to learn from you. And I want to start with, you know, ending the season on a win as a national champion. I want to know, like, what was the magic? What was the secret sauce with that group? What did they do that separated them? And just kind of walk us through the specialness of that team and that season and that group.
So that's an interesting question, the secret sauce, because if we could figure it out, or if there was such a recipe, we would all bottle it up and we would practice it. We would roll that out every year as part of our game plan, and we would do it.
I was hoping you would give us that today.
Well, I'll tell you what it came to be, and it's difficult to plan for it, and every team's is different, and you know all the personalities and all the, you know, the challenge and the hurdles and everything a team goes through throughout the course of a year, or in a junior college situation, you know, guys are together in 2 years. Last year was unique, like a lot of colleges around the country. We had players for an extra year. So we had a couple COVID holdovers that we had some 3-year players. Whereas in often, if we get an extra year out of a player, it meant that they had the red shirt. They had probably had some type of injury, and that's why they were around. But we had some players play 3 seasons, which was really unique. And, you know, it reminded me of the days back when I coached in the NCAA that, you know, how much development can happen in that third and fourth year. Just having the extra year was special with some of those guys, the connections and really just mm-hmm. watching them grow as players and, you know, with regard to, you know, as humans, it was pretty cool. But I would say we've been fortunate, and last year was my, let me count now. You know, when you get old, you stop counting. But last year was my 14th year at Gloucester, and we had been to a World Series every but one of those years. So we won one previous in my team. Our college has won 8 national championships. I've won 2. Barry Davis, who was on your podcast, won 4. He was kind of like the founding father of the program who really put us on the map. And then Mike Dixon, who's an amazing coach at Rowan University, he won 2 himself. In between my stints there. But, you know, we've had teams, I've been lucky to coach teams that are in that national championship game or in the Final Four pretty regularly. And last year's team wasn't our best team we've ever had. It definitely wasn't our best pitching staff, not by a long shot, that we've ever had. But I would say they loved playing with each other. about as much as any team in 25, 30 years as I've ever seen. They truly were friends, and they would come out early, and they would spend a lot of time in early work and just have a good time with it. There was no animosities between starters and backups, or, you know, someone who may have lost their job. I mean, there was just no bitterness. It was truly 28 players pulling really hard for one another. And the worst part about winning the last is like it ended. And guys, I remember guys kind of had an emotional moment the next day. They're like, I may never see some of these guys again. I'll never play with some of these guys. And these have become my best friends and my best teammates I've ever had. And I sensed it, you know, being around and being with different teams. I sensed as we were getting down the stretch there, I had a buddy who had won the national championship in Omaha. You know, he understands championship teams. And he said, you know, how do you feel? I said, I feel great because they love each other. They love playing. They're having fun. We could have done anything. They were having fun. And that type of team, it's hard to beat those guys, especially right. when they're as talented as they are. How do you win a game against guys that are truly grabbing the rope for each other and, you know, holding on and picking each other up? That's how you win a national championship. It's hard to create it. You know, we try to, you know, in culture, you know, if you do all the things right, you have a chance to have a group like that. But it's I don't know. Someone who's been to a lot of, you know, junior college World Series and sure. NCAA, you know, region tournaments and that, I don't know how to put it together. So this year is a whole new experience.
Well, wonderful. That was my next question is, you know, how do you feel like you created it with that group? And maybe you did it, you know, it was just something that they did themselves, but were there opportunities that you do create to bring a team closer together that maybe they took advantage of, or, you know, anything that you did to really foster that? Because again, we can put them in all the situations we want and we can spend as much time together, but that chemistry, a lot of it is based on the players and the group that you have. But with that group, is there anything that you do just yearly or with that group that you did last year to try and create that from the top down?
If there's any one thing I would say we hang our hat on, if I could give us any credit as a program, I would say our culture is rock solid. I'm proud. I'm most proud of our culture. And, you know, we get performances and obviously great players and draft picks and it's got all that's great. Awesome championships. But our culture is what I think we collectively in the end, as we move forward, our culture is rock solid. And in that, I say we try very hard to keep a manageable roster. And we live in a world now of 50, 60 players in the fall has become the norm. I don't understand it, but it's the norm. We live in a college baseball culture where nothing is guaranteed. I mean, cuts are happening now. I mean, players are being released and didn't expect it. So we've kind of kept the old way of doing it, try and make great decisions on recruits and then work very as hard as we can to develop them and keep a manageable roster. I say this to our team, and I think this helps with buy-in because players today, they want to know what can I get out of this? And I understand that. And this is a stop along the way in their careers, and I respect that. But any player in our program is just one move away from the starting lineup. So what I mean by that is we'll just have two players at a position. You know, there'll be maybe you got left, right-hand platoon. Maybe you have, you know, players out of the bullpen, different roles. But any player at any given time is just one move away. And I think that can happen when we keep a roster of about 30, and that's where we are now. But that's how you can – so if they feel like they have a role, and that role is valuable to the team and to them and to their career and to their teammates, they show up every day ready to work, and they start pulling for the team because they know I have a role, and success of our team depends on me. In whatever large way or small way, everyone has a role. Everyone has a chance in a given week in our program. In a given week, and we play kind of a condensed schedule. We start taking trips south in February, and we start to play in you know at home in March. And in that in a week, we might play six games in a week, seven games in a week, five games in a week. In any given week, every player on our roster is going to have a chance to impact the game, and that goes a long way. And at that point, I don't have to give them a speech. I don't have to tell a long story. I don't need as many words of encouragement. At some point, the ball, the bat, the glove will be in their hand with a chance to impact the game. And they know it, and it's been year after year. And I think that is a tremendous advantage for us in our culture. We value everyone as if, when, mm-hmm. if you came to a weight training session, which we're in now, or a practice, or if you didn't know who the best players are, so to speak, if you didn't know who had the stats or who's being recruited or scouted, and you just watch the way we coach them or the reps they get or the involvement or the interactions, you wouldn't know. And I'd like to believe, you know, you would think we're coaching them all equally. Everyone's getting the same amount of reps. You know, everyone hits BP on the field. Things that I think we've lost in you know, some places in college baseball, the development piece.
Sure. No, absolutely. I love the way you phrase that. And you're very, obviously very inclusive within that and open and candid. And I mean, with the environment that we're in, and actually today it was passed in Oklahoma that you can have a one-time transfer rule in high school. And so
we're all, I know.
I'm very mixed on how I feel about that one. We'll save that for after the mic, but yeah. So, I mean, from the top down, if you don't feel, you know, we don't welcome them into the group, then it's something that they, you know, especially with you, they may have opportunities to leave all over the place. And so I love hearing that. And I love your advice there. And so let's go into, this next fall. So like you had the summer to, I'm sure you're like, you know, you're driven like most of the coaches that we get to talk with, and you enjoyed it for a couple of days and you're like, okay, like 2024, let's do this again. And so what did the summer look like for you? Like, was there any moments of reflection of like, okay, I really like this and I did this, and just kind of getting yourself ready for the fall? And then we'll hop into, you know, when the players got on campus. But I, from a personal level, what did the summer look like for you? And did you dig into anything interesting, or just kind of, yeah, walk us through that?
Well, that's the interesting part. And I say this, people will say to me, hey, is it easier to recruit now? You won another national championship. And I said, actually, no. In this era, we would have been better off being eliminated in the region, having an extra couple weeks to be out on the road recruiting, but having two or three guys in the draft. The recruits would have been more excited about, you know, our players being selected in the draft than they are of you know, a team award, a team championship. And that's on the front end. That's on the, you know, before they arrive. Once on the backside of that, when they're departing our program, they're most proud of the team accomplishments. The success comes, the scholarships, the draft. I mean, the rising tides raise all ships. And they find that out, but they don't understand that on the way in, because it is, like you mentioned, now you have a transfer waiver in your state for high school players. My first instinct was, are they mature enough to understand why they should or should not transfer out of a program? And then, does it, due to high school baseball, what's happening for sure in the travel baseball world is they become consumers, you become a salesman as a high school coach, and now we're just trying to keep the consumer happy and, you know, to keep our bosses off our backs and, you know, to put a product out there that we're proud of. But are we selling a product, or are we doing the right thing, making good decisions, or are we just keeping the consumer happy by all means? That's a slippery slope. I don't envy anyone in that situation. And, you know, I've had all the jobs. I've been a Division I head coach, and I've been a scout. I've been a top 20 Division I assistant coach. I've had all the really cool jobs in college baseball. And what I will say is, where I am now in junior college baseball and where our program is, I don't have to be consumer driven. We can make good decisions, have a student athlete first mentality, quality of student athlete experience with our job. I truly believe our job is to move them to the next level and develop them while they're with us and provide a great experience and treat them fairly and really develop all of them. So I don't have to get into, hey, if I don't get this kid in the game, he's going to go in the portal. You know, if I don't give him a start here, is he going to go in the portal next week? Mm-hmm. But I'm seeing our friends in college football are dealing with this right now, and this is definitely an issue in our world.
No, definitely, for sure. So let's talk about, you know, this next team that you've got. So you get them in August. What's kind of your focus for the, you know, just kind of walk us through really your player development calendar. So we can talk from the first week on, or you can just kind of hit on some highlights. So you can go wherever you'd like with this.
I appreciate it. We start the first day of fall semester class. So for us in New Jersey, this is a, you know, a lot of beach towns, New Jersey, everybody runs, you know, as we call it, down the shore. We run to the beach in the summer, and that summer season ends on Labor Day weekend. So all the schools, everyone gets started the day after Labor Day. It's like back to school here in New Jersey. So, we do that, myself included. I'm at the beach Labor Day. We move back home, and then we get right to it. So we start that next day, first day of the semester, and then we're on the field every bit of September and October. And the one thing that I think is unique about our program, and I say this, kind of my claim to fame about our program, I say we play the best fall schedule in college baseball. And here's why I say that. We're fortunate enough that we can play lots of games. This year we had 13 dates, which, you know, these are doubleheader days. So basically a 26-game fall schedule where we're playing every weekend. We're playing Saturday, Sunday, or Friday, Saturday. You know, we're playing some combination of every day in the weekend. And we're lucky enough that the NCAA schools in our area, they play us. So we play Seton Hall and Monmouth and Rider and University of Delaware and Towson University. So we're playing an amazing Big East, Colonial Conference, MAC Conference. We're playing a Villanova University. We're playing an amazing schedule against Division I's and a couple Division II schools up here. And it puts together a 20-plus game schedule that otherwise you know, other places just don't have that opportunity. So it's kind of baptism by fire where I say we become like a football team in the fall. We practice Monday through Friday, and then we go play a lot of innings on the weekend. And it's like a football, you know, player development. You have a chance to practice all the things you think you need to get better at. And then you get a chance to go and see how good you are on the weekend. And then you probably learn a lot of lessons in the games and then right back to the drawing board on Monday. And we're lifting weights, and we're fitting in all the player development pieces throughout those weeks as we go. But it's a great opportunity to practice and then play high level college baseball games, where our freshmen, I mean, they're getting tested. It might be their first outing, and they're pitching against a Big East team or a Colonial Conference team. They're pitching against some of these great universities, and there's no way better way to test yourself, see where you stand, and see what you need to work on.
No, that's really good. And so what are you guys doing now? So we're, you know, first week of December, you guys play that crazy schedule. And then I'm assuming, well, I don't know what the restrictions are up there, but and then I'm assuming that school is going to be out pretty soon. So what have you guys chosen to focus on this time of the year?
So we do that. We're on the field until the end of October, sometimes the first week in November, depending on where we are and, you know, how well we got through that. And then we transition out of that to more of a 4-day-a-week lift. And so strength and conditioning becomes a priority in November. Although the weather's great. I mean, today it's 50 degrees and, you know, sunny. We could honestly play in New Jersey. We could honestly play a full season right up until the end of the fall semester, which ends for us next week. We're in exams at the end of this week, next week. So, but we at some point we've got to come off the field and get into more individual workouts. So at that point, November, we prioritize strength and conditioning. Our pitchers, for the most part, are shut down for 3 weeks in that period, and then we start a slow, long ramp back to opening day with two throwing programs a week. Then we go to three, then we go to four. You know, it's just we have the ability to go long and slow, which has been a recipe for us that we feel like has helped our pitchers really recover from a long stretch. A lot of, you know, they pitch high school season, summer ball, long fall. They're ready for to switch it up and get off the mound. And then, so our pitchers are in that 4 days a week strength. They are, and then we'll ramp up as we are now. Now we're at 3 days a week throwing program, short distance. I think we get up to 100 feet and that's it. We don't, it's not a high volume, high intensity yet. That'll kick in December. the hitters continue to hit. So we have, you know, obviously indoor and outdoor batting cage facilities on our campus. So our hitters will continue to hit. But that's it. Now we get into individual stuff, you know, where everybody's, you know, has an offensive plan, what they're trying to do with their swing, and everyone's getting bigger, faster, stronger this time of year.
I love it. And, you know, you've got – when do you guys start when you come back from break?
So we'll start – same thing. We start the Saturday – I could get my date wrong. I didn't get there yet. Yeah. Saturday, January 13th, 14th, in there. So middle of January – we'll okay. start pitchers, you know, they'll all go home for break. Mm-hmm. Some of our players live locally, so they'll still come train at the, on campus. They'll use the facilities and get their workouts in. About half our team is from what I call out of the area. They might be from New Jersey, but not within a, you know, they live on campus with us. So they go home, they train at their academies, facilities, you know. And then when they come back, the pitchers are throwing in that mid-January. They'll throw a 20-pitch bullpen. And then we open up the middle weekend of February, almost we stick to that NCAA Division I calendar. Whereas, you know, in Florida and Texas and that, they're playing JUCO baseball in January. But we get that mid-February start date. It's a good time for us to start traveling into the Carolinas and play. And so really they get a good 6 weeks of ramp up to get to a point where we're just increasing their pitch counts by 10, assuming they stay right on schedule, we'll increase their pitch counts by 10 pitches a week. And then by the time we get to opening day, they're ready to throw 70 pitches. We wouldn't throw 70, but we'll be more in the 50s, maybe the 60, depending on who they are. And then we'll grow their in-game pitch count that way. Again, try and be similar to about 10 pitches an outing. We have found that we don't try to ramp them up too quick. We've been fortunate enough that we have a pitching staff where we could pass the ball, meaning we trust a variety of pitchers to go and play a role in a game, and we could still win the game. And that's been beneficial because I know what it's like when you don't have enough pitchers to maybe give yourself a best chance to win a game, and you're leaving pitchers out there a little too long, a little too early, and it just never works out the way that you want. So we're fortunate enough to keep them all strong. When they're tired, get them out. When they're feeling good, let them finish up. But long inning, we make that their last inning. We're conservative because we feel like we're going to be playing on the last day of the season. And fortunately enough, we've been playing that game for quite a few seasons now.
Right. Yeah, no, I that's really good. And when you focus on preseason, so you talked about individual period in the fall. When you get back from break, is that when you start to focus on like the team development? So you're thinking like, cuts and relays and bunt defenses and first and thirds and all of that different stuff. Do you wait till January?
So in our climate in the spring, in January, now it's hit or miss, but typically we'd have to assume we're going to be inside till about the middle part of February till we start to get outside. And we've got a great indoor setup where, there's a private academy just a mile from our campus that we rent out every day, and 8 batting cages, full length cages. We could go live to hitters. And then there's a big turf infield on the other side. So we can get all of our work done indoors, you know, same way other than full field stuff. You know, we could get a tremendous amount of work accomplished inside. And then what happens typically is, and we've got outside turf areas. So what a typical preseason for us is, hey, which days of the week can we sneak outside? Mm-hmm. How long can we be outside on any given day? We're just playing the weather at that point. We're flexible, and it's pretty common to be inside, outside, you know, maximizing your space and time. So we try to get all those, what I call full field things, relays and things that we can't do so much of in the preseason. We really hammer those in the fall. And then in the preseason, I think the best thing that we have is that we are inside, because I'll say this, we typically have say 16 hitters. We have 8 batting cages with, you know, 5 or 6 pitching machines. And, you know, we have what we need to really develop. So there's 2 guys to a cage with tees, screens, and machines to really, really, really work on their swing and get lots of swings in a short period of time. So as that's happening, then we've got this turf infield square that we can go take all of our ground balls, all our double play feeds in a really controlled environment. And what you find out is, or in my opinion, when we're outside, we get in the habit of hitting team batting practice, and it really takes up a lot of time. Mm-hmm. And in that time, if you really scrutinized yourself and you said, okay, in batting practice, how efficient is this? Like, how many players are getting better at any given time? And the way we do it is we go, you know, we hit in groups, and one group is always running the bases. So if we say we have four groups of four guys on the bases with a point of emphasis with a coach, four guys hitting on the field, four guys in the batting cage, and then four guys playing defense off the bat. So we try to maximize it, but it's still not perfect. You know, you still just have in those at any given time, you have four players up or active at any given time. And that means you've got, you know, 12 players down or not active on a particular rep. Inside for us, and this is typical in Northeast teams, and I was lucky enough to coach at Rutgers University for a Hall of Fame, Fred Hill. And he was a master of preparing teams for the to start the season by maximizing inside and just doing all the things you could do and not much waiting around, just really being efficient with your time. And now with all these indoor, I mean, all of our indoor stuff is turf and good space and, you know, full distance bases and all the whole thing. So we could, you know, we take ground balls. You know, we do all the bunt stuff. So you could do your whole, and I learned this at Rutgers. We were always really prepared for the bunt game. We were to offensively and defensively, we were really prepared. We were always very prepared for first and third situations because that's all you had. That's the space you had and that's what you could really get done. So I've carried that. And I feel like we are very prepared to start the season in those ways. And even if you get a bad weather, maybe you get a snowstorm, maybe you get, you know, where you're off the field for a period of time before you open up. The one thing you'll be a little short on is some fly ball stuff. Could give you a hard time, a pop up in the sun, which you haven't seen, you know, you go sure. down to Florida and we haven't seen the sun, you know, like that in a while, but some of those things, but when it comes to the short game, being able to execute a bunt or all, you know, pick the bases and all those things. We try and make that a strength coming out, and then we try and grow, you know, the rest of it as time allows.
No, I love that. And, you know, while you're talking about how to develop in the Northeast or in the North in general, whenever it's cold, what are some of your favorite things to do indoors or things that you found to maximize efficiency and any tips and tricks that you've got to, you know, because I'm thinking a lot of our audience is amateur coaches. And so you may have like the back half corner of a gym or, yes. you know, just any, you would know a whole lot more about that than I would. And so I'd love to hear more about that.
I think some of the best things that you could, well, I will say, I think it's great for pitchers because pitchers, when they throw indoors, think about it. They're throwing off a perfectly sloped turf mound, which we don't always play on in our, you know, in our seasons. So you really take away any external. They're always throwing in great weather. There's no wind. There's no cold. There's no cold in between. They're in perfect conditions. They're able to get all their work done and think about, and the coach can go stand next to them because, you know, if you're not on the field and someone's hitting a line drive back at you, but it's really conducive to working with pitchers in optimum environment to develop those guys and get them ready for the season. But I would say what has helped me, I'm a phys ed teacher by trade, I guess. You know, my first job, I was elementary phys ed, and I did that for a few years as I was breaking into the college game. Those phys ed teachers, if you ever want to know how to sneak a game in or be flexible or use space or use modified equipment, those guys are usually really good at it. And I think I learned some lessons on how to maximize space and move people around and do it. One thing I'll say is the bunt game. I don't know if I'm speaking a different language, but if people still bunt anymore, but you don't need much space, but I really think you have to bunt off the machine. I think if there's sub-maximal velocity in the pitch, a hitter gets away with too many flaws to bunt the ball. I think bunting off the machine with some velocity, it doesn't have to be gas, but with some velocity, I think is much more valuable than bunting off, you know, a batting practice type pitch. We very rarely throw the pitch to a bunter. We like to get all our bunt work done off the machine. So that's helpful. And then even the way we warm up in stations. So our position players warm up, even outside. We warm up a little differently than the pitchers. You know, they've got a different package of movements that they focus on. They go a little longer in their ramp up before they throw. But a bunt station is part of our warm up. And so that's on the, you know, right on the game mound, and the pitches, we vary the pitch, but, you know, left-handed break ball one day, fastball another. So all the bunt game they're getting done is a warm-up station. Then we throw med balls, we do dynamic stuff, we're doing all mobility and different movements and footwork and high hurdle and low hurdle. So we have a station type approach to our warm-up, which I have found in 20 minutes, we can really get our bodies. We can improve mobility, not just warm up, but improve mobility. And at the same time, you're giving them a little bit of a mental break, because I haven't met an athlete yet that likes to warm up. I don't know. It's right. And I don't think I did either, but sure. They don't like to, as we say, stretch, although we're not doing much static stretching, but they don't like to warm up. But to add the bunt in there is a valuable time to get an important piece of our game in and almost give them a little break in the action. So station work, circuit work, I think is an excellent way to mix it in.
Absolutely. No, that's really good. So you get to mainly through your preseason, and then you guys are starting, you know, January, and then you're hitting it rolling or hitting it running, and you've got like, you know, 3 or 4 games a week. And so just tell us a little bit, do you guys go south, and then are you traveling the whole time?
No, we play, the last 2 weekends in February, so that middle weekend and then the last weekend of February, we'll travel south. We always, for many, many years, we would always go to Florida, and that would be a typical thing. Florida, just for our budget, has become incredibly expensive. I mean, it's now what used to be a $20,000 trip is now a $40,000-some trip. You know, we would stay in some economical, you know, hotels. They weren't the greatest, but they were safe and clean. That's kind of gone by the wayside. You know, you have some that have just gone bad, and then some that are just too expensive. Flights are more expensive. It just became financially impossible to go to Florida. So we take 2 bus trips, which I actually like better. For $20,000, we could travel into the Carolinas, play some different opponents, and go to Southern Maryland. And we could get 2 weekend series in weather that's just fine, 50, 60, 70 degrees. And we can do that. And I like it a lot better. It allows us to start earlier, which our players are ready to start. Once you start seeing the Division I guys on TV and going, you don't want to be sitting home. So we start at the same time. We feel like we're right in it. And then by the time it's March, I can't remember the last time we weren't, you know, playing games on good, dry, you know, ready to go field and climate in the beginning of March. So okay. Yeah, it's been that.
So, you know, when going through that, I don't think I've ever asked anybody this. What is the, like, what's the process going into that? Because you're on the road for a long time. So just kind of walking us through teaching these, because you're getting young 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds, and some of them may have never been on that long of a road trip in their lives. What is like the pre-work that you do to make sure that you guys are prepared and you guys understand the expectations going into stuff like that?
You'll laugh. The one thing I do, I will say, kids in our players, young players in our part of the country, they've been on this travel ball circuit where they're playing all over the place. They've kind of done it. So I've seen over the years, they're much more in tune with traveling into a hotel and playing on the weekend, you know, and playing a series or whatever, playing a tournament. Sure, they're much more in tune than they ever were. But I will say the one thing I tell them, and the freshmen don't believe me, I've got like a, you know, Word document that I've come up with. I tell them what to pack, because I think they, you know, what I've saw, the freshmen come in, they pack like they're going on that senior trip. They've got all their outfits and their hair gel and their, you know, Jersey kids with the hair gel. You know, they've got all these things. I say, guys, you need probably a sweatsuit for the hotel. You need all your baseball equipment and maybe one clean shirt when we go out to dinner. Other than that, we're not going to the Bahamas on vacation. This is a baseball trip. So we've allowed them to cut down on their packing a lot more. But other than that, I think they've been okay. And I even will say, like, back in the day, junior college, there would almost be like a behavior piece to traveling with a team. You know, if it was new to them and different, you know, young people, if it's something's new, they might not know how to handle it. Our players have become much more businesslike. You know, they know exactly how to do it. So, yeah. But the interesting thing this summer, the NJCAA, we're taking a team of the best 24 junior college players to Amsterdam to play in the top international tournament of the year of 2024. Yeah, so it's in a 4-year cycle in international baseball. One is the Olympics, which starts back up the next one where baseball is back involved. The other one's World Baseball Classic, which we always watch. But the two other years in that 4-year cycle is this tournament, this international tournament in Amsterdam in Holland called Honkbal Week. And as I've come to learn, honkball just means baseball. So it's the top six international teams all converge on Amsterdam in July and then play for a world championship, so to speak, or for that tournament. So this year it's a team of junior college players. And I guess that's the niche. That's how I got a chance to be involved. And Marty Smith at Central Florida and Mike Davenport, three of us are going to coach the team. So I've been thinking a lot about, we have to take 24 junior college guys to Europe. So how do I prepare those guys for that travel? That's going to be an interesting challenge.
Oh yeah, for sure. And Amsterdam is not a city without its vices either.
well, and that's what I wonder. So we're going to take 19, 20, maybe 21 year old guys to Amsterdam. Right.
Sure. I hear it's a beautiful city and people love it. So, you know, it's got the red light district, like shtick to it, but I do hear that it's a wonderful city and, you guys will love that trip. I bet that'll be awesome. And it'll be very culturally eye opening for them too, as well.
Yeah. For all of us. I'm really looking forward to it. I'm so proud to have an opportunity to wear USA on my uniform and, you know, something I've always wanted to do and was lucky enough that I kind of got a call out of the blue. Would you be interested in? Absolutely. Sign me up. Mm-hmm. So that'll be an exciting piece of my 2024.
Well, wonderful. Well, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, in season and trying to continue to develop as the season goes on. And you've done this for a few years. And so I want to know, like, what are your routines like? Like pregame, like how do you, cause you're a guy who you've talked several times about maximizing space and maximizing reps and understanding like time. So I would like to know, how do you continue to develop in season? What's some advice that you could give to me and any of the listeners who want to try and maximize the time? Cause we play, you know, in Oklahoma, we play four, sometimes five games a week as well. And we don't have a lot of, like, we have one set day every week to practice, which would be Wednesday. And then we may have another one, but there may be games played on our field and you know how that goes. So
I do.
I'm constantly searching on better ways to be able to try and develop the guys during the season. And we'll just kind of roll from there. So if you could answer that question, I got a couple more for you.
So that is that, Coach, that's the question. And I think that's the X factor. I think that's what separates good teams from great teams or good teams from bad teams. It's what do you do in the season? We would like to take our foot off the pedal and say, hey, we did all this work. And, you know, I hear this all the time, like, hey, well, that, you know, and watching a big league game, well, they haven't practiced that since spring training. Or, you know, I think there's almost this mentality that you get all geared up in your preseason or in college baseball in your fall season. You know, you go fall to preseason. And then once the season starts, I think sometimes coaches are so afraid to introduce new concepts or, you know, for lack of a better term, like continue to coach or make adjustments and make some changes or teach some new things throughout the course of the season. But I think that's essential. I think that's the difference. And I think the game presents so many teachable moments. I'm sure you do with your team. You know, like, hey, we didn't execute a rundown. I'll bet you next practice you're doing rundowns. Like, it's just, that's coaching 101. And the players are a much more captive audience. Once they failed at something in the game, they are more open and absolutely more motivated to and more focused on practicing it, you know. And sometimes until they fail, some players are uncoachable until they fail. And for us, I say this, I'm trying to give our players a 4-year baseball education in 1 or 2 years. And that's a challenge. And for us to be able to win a game in, say, the World Series, for us to be able to win at the end, win in the biggest moments, win in the championship games, we're going to play against some really good teams who have the ability to do some things in a game, to influence a game in such a way with their play that we have to be prepared for that. And I can't prepare. I challenge our team. I really challenge myself, but I say it out loud so then I'm held accountable to it. I challenge our team by saying, I guarantee you not one thing will come up in a game this year that we haven't practiced. Guaranteed. And I hold myself to that. So with, you know, if you make a claim like that, because I've been to a lot of baseball games and, mm-hmm. and I'm sure I always say you learn something new all the time. Like something Absolutely. Happens in a baseball game. You say, I've never seen that before. Isn't that so cool? Like, and that's probably what draws guys like you and I to the game. It's so unique that I've never seen that, or, you know, it happens all the time. So when I make a statement like that, really is I'm just calling myself out, like to say, we really, really, really have to get every, you know, every nook and crevice, every piece of this game, we've got to get it involved, including understanding the rules. Like I give my players a copy of the rule book preseason with the expectation. And then we talk, we ask a lot of questions like, hey, what would happen in this scenario? What's the rule? And they're expected to know the rule, because when it happens in the game, if you know the rules, you play fast. If you're unsure of the rules, you play hesitant, you play slow. It's the player who knows the rules the best will win the game. It's the coach too. I'm sure you see this. Like, you know, you'll see some coach arguing a rule and in your mind, you're like, he's got it all wrong. Like he doesn't even know the rules. How could you expect to win games if you don't know all the rules of the game? Because someone will know it. Someone will know them. So that's our challenge. Can we get everything in? Can we teach? Can we rep? Can we discuss? Can we review? Can we check for understanding on everything that occurs in a game that might come up in a baseball game, including sure. like, I mean, right up until the World Series, we're reinforcing things that are probably going to happen.
Mm-hmm. No doubt. Our high school started a officiating course to try and get more youth kids involved. And so mm-hmm. I've loved that some of our baseball players have taken that, and, you know, they're having to learn all of the other sports, but it's at least giving them a look yeah. inside the game within the game too. And I thought that, you know, I think that's great advice. I don't know. I know there's an app. I may send that to some of our guys too. It kind of breaks the rule book down into layman's terms. And I go on there from time to time, trying to figure out different rules and understanding the context behind it. But I really love the idea. I may even test them on it.
Yeah. So I've done that. So I get the test. I take the test every year. So I get one of my umpire buddies. He sends me the test that the college umpires have to take to recertify every year. And I take the test. And I've been doing this. I'll be honest. I really like to know all the rules. So I'm maybe a nerd if you say, like, how do you know that? I really, really know the rules. Take pride in it, spend a lot of time on it, have a lot of conversations with umpires. And I take the test. And if I get one wrong, I'm mad. I can't understand. You know, I think in my mind, I'm going to lose a game one day because I didn't know the rule. And I will say this. We have won games throughout my 30 years. Our team has won games because I've known the rule. And it's been – you know, if we had another hour on the podcast, I could tell you some great stories, but knowing the rules is essential. I would say that it's pretty cool that they offer that class, because a pretty good mm-hmm. side hustle for, you know, all these, you know, former student athletes, which they mm-hmm. will one day be, is officiating. That's a pretty good gig, you know. Mm-hmm. And my goal, I'd really like to have a former player become a major league umpire. It's cool if they're players, but I'd love to have a former player become an umpire. Because then you get free tickets for 20 years, not just a couple.
Nice. That'd be great.
Yeah.
No, it is cool. So they were trying to fight the umpire shortage, or the officiating shortage around here. And I thought that was cool too. One of our coaches teaches it, and it's a great gig to coach. And I thought that was really cool.
Are you seeing an umpire shortage in high school baseball in Oklahoma?
Right. Yes.
Yeah. Same in New Jersey. Very, very much so.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, with that, like, Let's talk a little bit about your pregame routine. So this is one thing that I want to try and improve, and we don't always have the flexibility that colleges sometimes have, to where you're there for a weekend, and so you've got a little bit more time. Some of the times we're having to get on the bus and go, and we're there maybe an hour before the game, and so we're trying to hustle up and get ready before in and out. But there are times that, you know, we have home games and we have a little bit of an extended period to be able to do some stuff on the field. So how would, if you were me, you know, we're in the middle of the season and we've got, you know, a couple hours before the game, how would you approach using that time to really develop the players and get them ready for the game?
I would say in our program, that's the most important time, because if we have 30 players, once the game starts, 10 play, 20 don't play. So if it's a game day, which, you know, for us play 56 games, most days are game days. You know, if it's not a game day, we might only have one, maybe two practices in a week. And of those, probably half of that time we allot to strength and conditioning. So, you know, a pregame is I think an important time to teach. So here's what we do. And I get it, in college they have this advantage, but I think high school players have to understand this a little bit better. I say this to the team early on. I think this is a lesson I'd like them to learn. I say, if you do everything, and we have a pretty detailed practice plan, and I say, if you do everything that we write in the practice plan, and you do it 100%, and you do every drill that we offer in practice, and you do everything that we ask you to do every day, you will never reach your potential. And then I follow that by saying that you would be good enough, but you'll never reach your potential. The player that will reach their potential is they come early and they do their early work. Just like, you know, the big leaguers or the little leaguers, whatever, you show up early and you do all your early work. So early work for us is incredibly important. And it has become so ingrained in our program that sometimes they come too early. Sometimes they need to be in the library a few more minutes and then come out a little later. But the early work is when you could work on all the little parts of your game that you need to clean up. So if you come to our field on a game day and you come out, you know, so let's say we play at 3 o'clock, by 11 o'clock, you're going to see a variety of different players out there doing a variety of things. Some bunting on the field, some taking ground balls, some hitting in the cage, some hitting different pitches off the machines. Pitchers, you know, with a screen in front of them, picking to bases, you know, working on a pickoff play. I think that's incredibly important, because anyone, the way they learn, everyone digests information at their own pace. So our goal is, can we empower them with information and then provide opportunities for them to practice executing that information? And that happens in early work, and it happens in their own way, and they do the things that they think they should do, and they're much more interested and motivated and focused to do those things that they think are important to their game. And then that rolls into team warm-up, and then we'll warm up as a team, and then we go from team warm-up to batting practice. And I think base running is one of those areas that you know, especially in junior college or high school, you win or lose games in base running. If you could base run better, you're probably going to win some more games that maybe you otherwise would not have. Definitely. So base running is a station for us that our pitching coach, Coach Chu, is actually an outstanding base running coach. He takes the base runners in BP. So I've got the hitters. He has the base runners. Our other coaches are, you know, throwing BP or doing their thing. And there is a point of emphasis or a couple points of emphasis every day. So he'll pick a base. He'll say, okay, you know, we'll set the screen up and they'll all go to third, or they'll all go to second, whatever. They'll pick a base. And then it will be for that round, you know, if each group has like a 12 to 15 minute round, it is a 12 to 15 minute. I mean, he is coaching with his hair on fire. He has so much information. He he's just dying to get it out. So that base running segment every day is really, really how we start to be better. Because I get it, and if you put base running in, like I used to do when I was a younger coach, we would do base running last, you know, in practice. And by the time you get to it, they're a little tired. They're not really interested in practicing base running maybe the way you are. And a lot of times I'd forget, or we'd skip it and go, mm-hmm. I forgot this part of base running. So now we put it in that segment of batting practice, and I think we get an awful lot out of it. So that's occurring.
Doing and live then, reads.
Yep, live reads, okay, and just all, whatever it is, or all the, yeah, that's exactly it. Live reads and whatever the teaching, the jumps, whatever we're using, the pitch to do it. So that's a big part of it. Go ahead. No, I'm with you.
No, I'm sorry for interrupting.
Are a little
that.
Long.
I can go.
But
no, I love it. And you're so what else were you saying? So you said that was a segment that you would put into for sure. What else?
Sure. And then, so they've all done their individual work before mm-hmm. team starts, and then team BP, and then even within team BP. So the group that's down the cage, so we put two hack attacks in a hack attack in each side, a right-handed and a left-handed breaking ball. So they're seeing both breaking balls. And then on the field, we do a variety of things. Oftentimes it's batting practice out of the hand so they can see it. But otherwise in practice, and what I've kind of evolved to is, you can't have enough pitching machines, and we really try and use the machines to simulate velocity, to simulate spin, just to add an element, a dimension of challenge to batting practice swings. BP out of the hand, it's hard to get it down, and it becomes sometimes home run derby, ish. And off the machine, it's a little more difficult to do that. Mm-hmm. You've got to lock in on a good swing much better. And then we do that, and we go right through, and then. I think that's a pregame routine where and then defensively we're not shagging. So here's the one thing I'll say. So in the infield, that's always pretty easy. Everyone does it. They'll play a ball live, and we'll have the screens out. So the infielders will play a ball live. They'll throw across, or we've got a screen in the middle, double play feed in the middle. So they have some play that they're trying to accomplish off every batted ball. The outfielders, I say this, we take our pitchers, and the pitchers have to be on the warning track. And a pitcher's job in batting practice is to pick up the ball when it rolls and hits the fence. Or more importantly, don't let the outfielders run into each other or the fence. So be their eyes and communicate and just keep them safe. Don't go catch a ball. Don't dive. Don't charge. Don't just – and you know what? If you really want to have fun, every once in a while, rob a home run. If that's the best thing, they could jump up and rob a home run. Then they, you know how the pitchers are. That'll make their week. So,
sure.
But the outfielders have to play those reps game speed. And then we say on every catch, there has to be a secondary play. So it's that, and if a guy doesn't, let's say he makes a long run catches and, just continues on and flips it to the bucket, I'll stop and I'll say, what were there two outs? Were there two outs? And he knows what I mean. And, what I'm trying to say is treat every ball like there's zero or one out, and treat every play like there will be a secondary play after the catch, which requires body control. It requires taking better angles on the catch. And I think we get a lot out of it for our outfielders during that segment of batting practice.
For sure. I bet. I've got a couple quick hitters for you, and then we'll, kind of talk through those. And I think, these are right down your alley. But first question is, you've mentioned this a couple of different times, but what are some different things that you feel like you do that are unique? And it's mainly because you felt like, okay, this is what most people do, and this is how I'm going to gain an edge. Or, this is what, for instance, for me, in between innings, we do a set routine that isn't just ground balls to each other. And, mm-hmm. or when we have a throwing program and play catch, everything is very intentional because all of that stuff adds up to a lot of time over time. And so I'm curious what some of those things are for you.
Very similar to you, it sounds like. And I'd love to come watch practice. I know you're doing amazing stuff with your team. That's so cool to hear. I would say what sets us apart is we never stop coaching them. I really love the teaching aspect of being a coach. So I say this for some, and you're around in different places, for some people, coach is a verb, and for some people, coach is a noun. I would like to be considered a verb. And where I gain joy, what I really appreciate most about coaching baseball is actually just coaching the players. I don't as much enjoy, I'm not concerned with people knowing I'm the coach. I don't care mm-hmm. about any of the externals. I just really like to coach. So. Right. If I go to my son's Little League game, if they would let me, I would run around on all the fields and coach all the players. I just truly enjoy coaching the game. And so for our pitching coach, Greg Chu, he's our assistant coach who's been with us, you know, for many, many years. He's outstanding. He is the exact same. He just loves to coach the guys. Like he just likes to coach them. So if I had to say that's what's the separator, is that we're just always coaching them. So we're coaching mm-hmm. them there. We're coaching them, you know, on in our text groups at night. Like, sure. you know, I don't know. Maybe I like to watch baseball. I like to watch baseball instruction, and I like to uh-huh. share that information. Other sure. people have other hobbies. Those are my hobbies. That's what I like to do. My wife watches reality TV. I watch baseball videos and then share it in the group chat. That's what I do.
I really like that a lot. What is a drill that your players love that we can steal from you?
I'll tell you a drill that's kind of an unsung hero drill that I think has a lot of value. And I'll give you the quick answer on how I learned it. So in 1997, I watched ESPN MLB spring training, and they showed Barry Bonds showed this drill where someone was throwing him the ball and he was acting like he was hitting with a glove on his top hand. And he was rotating as if he were hitting and catching the ball. If you follow what I'm saying, I'm trying to be descriptive, but so basically catching the ball as if the glove were the bat, and then, you know, in the, you know, catching balls deep and catching balls out in front and so on and so forth. So I thought that was a cool drill. Barry Bonds swore by it. I said, well, he's pretty good, so let's get our players doing it. I did it for a little while. The players didn't, you know, it's not a challenging drill, but it's an important drill. So it's almost like doing your mobility. It's not exciting. Like it's not like robbing a home run. It's not exciting, but it's like eating your vegetables. You have to do it. So it kind of faded away. And then I watched Chase Utley as he had a banner year. And he said, this is now years later, I'm watching him on like MLB TV. And he said, I learned this drill from Barry Bonds, and this drill I do every day, and it has really helped me have this amazing season. And he was doing the same exact drill. And I said, that's it. I'm committed. We're all in. We call it the catch it deep drill. So you're sideways and someone's flipping you the ball, and as if you were hitting, you stride and your top hand goes to it and you just catch the ball. It really wakes your eyes up. It really resets your hand-eye coordination. It really gives you a feel of getting your hips open. It does so many little things. It's not a long drill. It's just an every day before you swing a bat for just a minute, just 45 seconds, catch it deep. It almost just resets your timing. Because as you know, anytime we take any time off, including a day, we start swinging early. Like we don't recalibrate our eyes, hand-eye right. coordination.
That's good.
It's almost just a recalibration of hand-eye coordination in a slow way and intentionally catching the ball in the depth that you would see the ball a long time. We now do that every day, all day, every player. Mm-hmm. And I think it has a lot of value. I believe that it does.
Awesome. Another one is, what is the latest thing that you've learned that's made you better at your job?
I've learned that you have to adjust to individual players. I think they are the sum of a team is a collection of individual players with individual personalities, with individual motivations. The days, you know, and I've been doing this for a while, the days of just saying my way or the highway, this is the way we do it, this is how we do it, and if you question that, you're questioning everything about our team. To a degree, there's still value in that, but they are all individuals who come to us from a variety of backgrounds. They all learn differently, and there has to be some differentiated teaching to ensure that their learning outcomes are as successful as we would all like them to be. So if I had to say, I coach them all the same, I listen to them all as individuals, and I try and meet each one where they are as an individual. I'm trying to be better at that.
I love that. And then final question is, what is something that you feel like maybe you've implemented lately or you implemented early on that you feel like has made a tremendous impact on your program?
more focused in our training sessions on individual player development, more time on individual player development, and then still bringing it all together, you know, still, but think about our game. I mean, I say this, some things I try to live by in planning a practice and having some foresight in our development is practice what happens in the game, the way that it happens in the game, in the proportion that it happens in the game. And with that being said, try and have 100% participation 100% of the time. So I try and live by that. And, you know, whereas when I was young, we would practice some things, maybe some harder concepts. Say, like, let's say we would have 15 first and third offensive, you know, things we would try to do. And then we'd look back on the season and say, you know, we only did three of them. You know, we just run that same play and it works. So that's what we do. But I would try and come up and add in all these cool things to maybe make it seem like I knew something someone else didn't know. Where I've learned that just it fundamentals done, you know, do things simple, do them simply, you'll win. It's a fundamental game. Just make less errors, just throw more strikes. And I'm not trying to oversimplify, but I'm less concerned with doing things that don't happen that often in a game. And I'm much more concerned with the things that are happening regularly throughout the course of a game.
Sure. Well, Rob, I appreciate you, man. And I've loved getting to chat it up with you today and getting to learn from you. And your contact info is below. I'll link your email. And so if anybody has any questions for you, they can get in touch with you. But
absolutely.
Sure. Yeah. So if you would, though, I would love the opportunity to, you know, are you there? Sorry, you're cutting out a little bit.
Yep. Can you hear me now?
Okay, perfect. Yes, sir. Yeah. So I would love the opportunity to let you I'm going to mute myself and let you talk to our guests. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about or anything else that you'd like to say before you go?
I would just say this. I appreciate, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, my guess is you're invested in coaching young people play the game that we all love. And I really appreciate you for that. And we're all trying our very best to develop ourselves and grow the game and develop our players and make good decisions and be positive role models. So I just want to just reverse it and say, I appreciate what all of you are doing. I try and hold myself to a high standard and hold our program accountable for our outcomes. And I know you do the same. So I appreciate you giving it a listen today.
Thank you so much for listening to Ahead of the Curve. If you would do us a huge favor, leave a rating or review wherever you are listening. And if you enjoyed this episode, share it with someone and tag us on social media. That would help us so much with growing the show and helping others to stay ahead of the curve.